Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ajit Andori, and I'm the president of the Fordham Law Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, and separation of government powers is central to our Constitution. Today's event is entitled Hydrofracking and Shale Drilling, a discussion on natural gas drilling and its implications on the economy, the environment, and the law. And this event is part of the Templeton series on freedom, a national dialogue on law and liberty. Now I'd like to call up our VP, David Tupfer, who will introduce the speakers. Thank you all for coming.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is David Tupfer. I'm Vice President of the Federal Society here. I'd like to introduce our three speakers today, who came from far and near to speak on this topic. And this continues the tradition of Fordham FEDSAC of having at least one event a year on environmental law. Our first speaker is Christine A. Fazio, a partner at Carter Laird Milburn, LLP. Ms. Fazio practices in the area of environmental law, including environmental impact analysis, project permitting, compliance audits, and litigation. She does considerable work in the energy sector, including setting up new power plants, alternative energy projects, and transmission lines. For 3 years, Ms. Fazio chaired the New York City Bar Association Environmental Law Committee. Ms. Fazio is a graduate of Fordham University School of Law and has a Master's of Public Administration from New York University. Prior to her legal career, Ms. Fazio worked for over 9 years at the Environmental Protection Agency. Our second speaker is Peter J. Kams. Mr. Kams is an attorney admitted to practice in New York and Florida and focuses his area of practice on hydrofracking litigation, product liability, mass torts, and multi-district litigation. He currently appears as counsel in cases you may have heard about, such as federal multi-district litigation as BP Deepwater Horizon, Toyota Unintended Acceleration, In Re Light Tobacco Marketing Litigation, and In Re Chinese Manufacturer Drywall, just to name a few. He's lead counsel in several lawsuits filed in Pennsylvania involving claims of contaminated water supplies caused by drilling and hydrofracking operations, as well as claims arising in New York, West Virginia, Ohio, and Texas. He has tried in excess of 125 cases to verdict and has earned the highest Martindale-Hubbell rating of preeminent lawyer. He is a senior litigation counsel with the firm of Parker, Wakeman, and Alonzo LLP. Our third speaker is Dr. Michael P. Joy, PhD. He is a graduate of University of Buffalo Law School, magna cum laude, and with concentrations in real property law and environmental law. He's also a graduate of SUNY Buffalo with a PhD in geology. He studied the rock mechanics, basin evolution, and relationships between the Trenton Black River carbonates and Utica shale. While he was in law school, he authored three peer-reviewed journal publications on rock mechanics and structural geology, the Trenton Black River carbonates and the Utica shale. He teaches oil and gas law at SUNY Buffalo, and we're glad to have the three speakers here today. Ms. Fazio.
So I probably know the least about natural gas hydrofracking because I don't represent anybody in that area. I don't represent natural gas producers. I don't represent plaintiffs who are challenging natural gas producers for contaminating their water. I don't represent farmers who are granting mineral rights to their land. But I am familiar with the issues. There's been a lot in the press. I think if you've read the New York Times last week, there's been a whole series of stories of belt of concerns and hydrofracking. I actually believe we do need to recover this natural gas supply. I think there's a lot of benefits, but we have to address the risk as well. So I'm probably more neutral, take a very neutral position. So why do we care? You can see from this map, there's a vast supply of natural gas right here in the United States. And we could become independent of foreign sources of fuel. by obtaining this gas. The Marcellus Shale we're talking about today is what we call the Appalachian Basin. It's several thousand feet below the surface, starting in Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York. We talk about hydrofracking. You probably have heard terms that it's unconventional drilling. What this means, unconventional drilling, is you take a vertical drill down, but you can also now drill horizontally. So that's horizontal drilling. And then you add high-volume hydraulic fracturing, which is pumping a lot of water with sand, a little bit of chemicals, into the rocks, and the rock separates, and then gas is released. By this new technology, we are able to recover natural gas supplies that we couldn't recover before. And so the benefits, why do we want to do this? Why is this important to us? Well, we can become independent from foreign imports. Economic development is another reason. Upstate wants drilling. New York City doesn't. You know, we have the upstate-downstate divide, which is typical. But in Pennsylvania, a 2009 study from the University of Pennsylvania showed that the Marcellus gas industry in Pennsylvania would generate $3.8 billion, create 48,000 jobs, and provide $400 million per year in state and local tax revenues. So there's significant economic benefit by drilling here in New York as well. We also need more natural gas supplies because when demand for natural gas is high, particularly in the winter months, prices go up. So by drilling, we can also provide better natural gas price stability. And for environmental reasons, because of climate change and air quality issues, there is a big movement to convert coal-fired power plants and fuel oil combustion sources, such as residential commercial boilers, to natural gas. I just want to show you this map. Iran, the Qatar and Iran right now has the largest supply of natural gas. The second line, the green line, right to my left or your right, that's the Marcellus Shale. And in all these other little blue, show the natural gas supply in various areas of Russia. So we have a vast source of natural gas right here in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio. This just shows you the environmental benefits of burning natural gas as opposed to coal and oil. Far lower carbon dioxide emissions, particulate emissions, sulfur dioxide emissions, if we convert coal-fired power plants and other coal and oil combustion sources to natural gas. This is another graph I can't read, but there's also a push that, this is from the utility industry. There's a lot more environmental regulations coming down the pipe for coal-fired power plants. And you're going to see a need for coal-fired power plants to move towards natural gas, to convert to natural gas, because they're not going to be able to comply with all these requirements. Now, some of this may be changing with the new Congress. This was prepared before the elections. You do see EPA slowing down. But nonetheless, to address climate change and other air quality issues, you're going to see a lot more regulation of coal-fired power plants, and it's going to be too expensive, and there will be more need for natural gas resources. I just want to go up, actually. So there's the benefits. What are the risks? One is hydrofracking requires a large volume of water. And it's concerned that we may deplete drinking water wells, reservoirs, because of volume water. There's also a large volume of water that returns back to the surface and is being sent to wastewater treatment plants. And this large volume of water contains chemicals, lots of total dissolved solvents, and it's very salty. And the question is, can the wastewater treatment plants actually handle this waste? And that was some of the reports in the New York Times last week. They're actually now finding that there's radiation in this water. So the concern is the wastewater treatment plants cannot handle the volume of wastewater. There is a movement more recent for the industry to start to recycle the wastewater. Whether that solves the problem or not, you know, but that there is a movement to at least address some of the concerns. There's also been a lot of reported spills and accidents that have allegedly led to contaminated drinking water wells. The other issue is the significant truck traffic to bring in the water and to remove the wastewater. Most of the drilling is in rural areas, pretty landscapes, so you're having impacts to the landscape. that significant truck traffic is causing air, noise, quality concerns. I'm going to go back up again. You hear a lot about the chemicals in a fracking fluid. The actual fracking fluid is basically 99.5% water and sand. And less than 0.5% is actually chemicals. And so but when you look at the cumulative impacts, when you look at all the different the amount of water and wastewater generated, it accumulates. So even though it looks like it's very small, the amount of chemicals and petroleum distillates can contain benzene, that is the concern that you're hearing. And this just shows the flowback water. This is the water that may be going back to a wastewater treatment plant, contains a lot of different chemicals, the metals, chlorine. So what do we do? I think the real issue is the natural gas production companies need to really be proactive. They need to establish regulations. They need to set up best management practice. They need to come up with a really effective general permit. Right now, public perception is against drilling. By trying to avoid regulation, I think in the end, they've actually harmed themselves, because now you have moratoriums like in New York, and the public is just really against drilling. So they need to really step up to the plate and really come up with good practices. It also hurts them when they don't have records. For instance, a lot of stories about, they claim methane, sometimes these accidents, methane's in the drinking water, they didn't cause the methane or the water was already contaminated. But without monitoring of the wells, they don't have proof. So regulation actually benefits the industry because it gets rid of the bad apples and it gives them, and it basically ensures they even have records that protects themselves from liability. So my view, we should have natural gas production, we should, but we have to make sure we have the right regulations. We may not want to permit natural gas production in all the areas, such as the New York City watershed, and we have to address the cumulative impacts. Maybe we need some kind of distance where, you know, one drill for a quarter mile, whatever the right distance is to deal with the cumulative impacts. But I think we do need to look at the economic benefits and the environmental benefits of moving forward under strict regulations. Thank you.
Show of hands, who's a law student? One of the first things I remember as a law student is reading the case. And I would read the majority opinion. I'd say, that makes perfect sense to me. Why are we reading this case? Then I'd go ahead and read the dissent. And I'd say, damn, he makes a good point. And the point is that when we talk about most things as lawyers, one of the things I think law school teaches you is to step back and get the big picture. Because without the big picture, you cannot make informed decisions. And I'm dating myself, but there was a former president, Richard Nixon, who said, I'm not a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I'm not a tree hugger. I'm a full, fair, free market capitalist. And my opinions, what I say today, is not based upon my political beliefs, because quite frankly, I think I would probably side with the gas industry based upon my political beliefs. My opinions are based upon my experience and facts as I believe them to be and as I have seen them. I have several suits filed in Pennsylvania, Bradford and Susquehanna counties. I've been to Dish, Texas. I've seen what fracking in the natural gas industry has done to neighborhoods. And quite frankly, I was very shocked. I was very shocked. Let me explain to you, and I hope to try to back away from any myopic impression that you may have on both sides of the aisle, whether you're for fracking or gas drilling or against it. Let me just explain to you some of the technical aspects, and I don't want to spend too much time, but I know some of this might be new to people. You drill down 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet. You start with about a 24-inch hole, and you keep coming down. Then there's a kickoff point where you now can drill horizontal for about another 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 feet. And this is on a well pad. And then you pump down. When I say they, the gas company will then pump down fracking fluid. And there are fracking stages. Typical well will require maybe 10 fracking stages. What that fracking does, as the name implies, is it fractures the rock, fractures the shale around the bore, to help release the methane gas, which can then enter the bore and then get drawn up into the well where the well head is, and then taken and brought to market from that point. Now, it's important to remember that as they're drilling, they're going through the aquifer. The gas companies will say the aquifer is protected because we put a casing, a cement casing, around that bore to protect any communication between fracking fluid or gas that comes up and the aquifer. And then we're drilling so far down, thousands of feet below the aquifer, that there's no way the fracking fluid, 6,000 feet, can migrate up. Well, there's a dispute about that. Some scientists believe there are natural fissures that can, you know, help communicate or act as a conduit for those millions of gallons of fracking fluid to migrate. But the point is that it's important to remember that this is unconventional drilling. Each well will take about 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 million gallons of fracking fluid. It's about 500,000 gallons per frack stage. Multiply that by 10 fracking stages. Each well head has about 8 wells on it. So each well pad will use about 40 million gallons of frack fluid. Only about 20% of it comes back up and is reclaimed initially. So where I see the contamination is basically several categories. When that frack fluid gets returned, it's called flowback. And the flowback is not just fracking fluid. Gas companies will say it's perfectly safe. If it's perfectly safe, then why don't they disclose what's in the frack fluid? The flowback contains not only the frack fluid, but a lot of natural elements, if you will, below the surface. Very high salt content. Pennsylvania, you know, if you go back geologically, and Professor Joy will, I'm sure, talk about this, a lot of this water flowback is very salty. It can contain heavy metals such as barium, manganese. And I have seen this. I have clients where some are farmers, their cattle will no longer drink the water. People get sick. And the gas companies will say, look, in theory, there's no way this could happen. Well, I think what's happening now is as fracking and as the natural gas industries move into more relatively populated areas, the effect from this contamination is affecting more people. And you're seeing more litigation. It's no longer some remote area in Texas or some remote area in West Virginia. It's near Scranton, Pennsylvania. It's in Susquehanna County. And more people get affected. Most of the contamination, and I think as some of these cases come to light, and the DEP, which is Pennsylvania's equivalent to New York's DEC, have found that many of the casings that are used, and again, these are cement sleeves, if you will, have been either improperly installed or have cracked or shrunk, and it's now allowed communication, if you will, between the water supplies and the flowback or the methane gas. And I have clients where the DEP has determined that is the problem. Now, the gas industry will say, that's just an isolated problem. You know, every industry has its error rate, okay? Well, the statistics that I have seen, which I believe to be accurate, indicate that about 1/4 of all cement casings at the time of production or prior to production are faulty. Statistics also show that 3/4 of the cement casings will fail at some point. But what happens, and we've seen that the casings fail. I think the oldest production high-volume fracking well in Pennsylvania is about 4 years old. So this sort of unconventional drilling in the Marcellus, which is very permeable, has not been around that long. And we start seeing endemic Pennsylvania, in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, that this compromise of cement casings causing contamination. Basically, a couple of types. One is methane or fugitive gas migration, where methane, which is in the rocks, gets into the well bore, okay, comes up and is allowed to communicate because of casing problems into the aquifer. I have a client, and you've seen it on TV. If you haven't, it's on YouTube. You can light the water up. You turn the faucet on, you can light the water up. He had now has Chesapeake, which is the oil company, has well, the gas company, has put a PVC sleeve on his wellhead. Now, most of you might be in the urban areas. You don't know what a water well looks like. But it's a head that, you know, it's a wellhead that sticks out of your front yard. You've got a PVC pipe. And you can see vapors come off. You put a match up there, that's going to light up. His water is effervescent. It's like somebody put a an Alka-Seltzer tablet in there. He's never had that before. And you can think it's an isolated incident. But then you go down the street and somebody else reports the same fact pattern, the same sequelae, the same evolution effect. And then you go a half a mile beyond. And you start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, you realize that this is a problem. And I almost, my time is up, but I just want to kind of fast forward, if I could, to some of the damage aspects, which is not being addressed, and create some very interesting questions of law. And that is this. If my client, I'll call him John Smith, has a methane problem in his well, who's going to buy his house? If he's got contamination, or his well has been contaminated because when they were drilling, they got into the aquifer and caused dissolved solids, barium, manganese levels to go up, who's going to buy his house? And even if the contamination clears up, who's going to buy his house? What bank is going to write a mortgage on that house? Who's going to compensate him? Nobody's going to compensate him. These are what's called stigma damage, and it's a very interesting area of law. Where that property has been stigmatized, you've got 20 or 30 million gallons of frac fluid under your house, or under a house or a farm that you want to buy. That's going to flow back. That fluid still flows back for years and years and years. If you're a title company, are you going to write title on that property? Are you going to be able to get a mortgage on that property? The gas company's not going to pay you. That's not a taking. It's not contaminated. It might be contaminated somewhere down the road. But these are some very interesting issues that come to light. So my time is up, and I hope you have a lot of questions at the end. Thank you.
Debate lecture on Marcellus Shale this week. It's Tuesday. And I'm already agitated. And I've been agitated for the last several years. Because I'm an unapologetic believer in American energy independence. I'm also an unapologetic believer that if we use it, we should have responsibility for it. The lights didn't magically come on today. You know, when you flip the switch, it's not how you actually turn a light. There's a lot more to it. What we don't talk about, for the most part, is that New York State uses about, I shouldn't let me rephrase that. New York generates about 40% of its electricity using natural gas. Anybody have an idea how much we produce, if any? Well, we do produce some. We produce about 6%. It's about 45 billion cubic feet of gas a year, which should sound like a fairly high number. It is. That comes from over 14,500 producing natural gas wells in New York State alone already, over 90% of which were hydraulically fractured. Fracking, by the way, is a new buzzword, but it's actually hydraulically fractured. Unfortunately, we produce far less natural gas than we need. The next major source of electricity is thermogenic power generation, coming predominantly from coal. Possibly the worst greenhouse gas emitter that you can find is coal. So we want to do something in the short term to clean up the environment. I think most people would agree that reducing our dependence on coal is essential. We talk about natural gas as the bridge fuel because natural gas has some unique properties. It's relatively cheap. The burner tip price today, the price you would actually pay in your kitchen when you turn it on, is about the equivalent of a gallon of gas being $1.50. You all know, yeah, gallon of gas is far more than that. It's abundant. As far as you actually took about two-thirds of what I was going to say, so I'm sort of on the fly here. It's abundant. And it's local. We finally have the opportunity to achieve real American energy independence and rid ourselves of our dependence on foreign oil. And if you don't think that that's important, just take a look at what's going on in the Middle East right now. Look at the unrest. And look at the effect at gas pumps and on the American economy, price of an airline ticket. And understand that we actually don't get much oil from the countries now suffering in the Middle East. Less than 2%. Yet we see gasoline prices going up somewhere between 16 and 25% in some cases, based just on international unrest. So our dependence on foreign oil is costing us a tremendous amount. These are just some of the general reasons why natural gas is a fuel that we need to take a look at, and a little bit about why we should start taking some responsibility for ourselves. I want to touch on a couple of points, the first of which is the issue of unconventional. I do want to correct the previous speakers. Unconventional doesn't refer to the fact that we do it horizontally. We've been doing that for decades. I was in the late 90s working in Aramco when we drilled 25,000 feet horizontally in the South China Sea. It's not a new technology. Nor is hydraulic fracturing. We've been doing that since the 40s. We've been doing it in New York since the 60s. What unconventional actually refers to is the fact that we can now tap the source rock. In a typical hydrocarbon system, you need a source, you need a reservoir, and you need a seal. And finding those components are actually fairly difficult. There's a lot of source, there's a lot of reservoir, there's some seal. Finding them all together is not that easy. But when you can now go into shales, these source rock, organic, rich, shallow basin deposits, and go directly into the shales and tap that source, you open up wide expanses of natural gas. That's what unconventional refers to. It refers to the fact that we're now able to go in and tap source rock. A couple of issues about that we see in Pennsylvania. Oyster Camp left out is that in Dimmick, Pennsylvania, where they light their taps on fire, which I admit is very dramatic, especially if you watch Gasland, see him turn on his tap and light it. My God, of course that's bad. Except, of course, that they've been able to do that in Dimmick, Pennsylvania for decades. Long before there was a natural gas well anywhere near Dimmick, Pennsylvania. Why? Because there's a lot of natural gas in the Appalachian Basin. Tremendous amounts of natural gas in the near surface. There's a lot of natural gas existing in the aquifers, places where people are putting their water wells. It's not unusual, fortunately, to have poor water quality in some of these areas because there is a lot of endemic natural gas. What I found working for the companies that I have the good fortune to work for is that they do take the safety protocols from the modern industry. More often than not, the industry is out ahead of the regulators, going toward, for instance, recycling. In 2009, there was about 20% of the companies doing recycling. By the end of 2010 in Pennsylvania, they had reached about 90% recycling. At some point, you have to dispose of it. Cutting-edge technology is already here. It's the industry pushing the regulation, not the other way around. So that's already going on. Final thing I want to touch on, just because we have a limited amount of time, is the issue of property rights. In the United States, we're fortunate. We own what's underneath our property. We don't own the natural gas. What we own is the right to drill and explore for it. So when we're talking about interesting legal questions, let's talk about the question of damages to the person who's been prevented from tapping natural gas by the moratorium that's in place in New York. And let's talk about damages. I'm not talking about the damages from the inability to sell one's house, which incidentally I don't believe is true. Nor am I talking about the damages from contaminated wells, which incidentally I've never seen in the case. Talking about damages measuring billions of dollars by the regulatory taking of what's fundamentally American property rights.
We're now going to have a short rebuttal from each of the presenters, and then we're going to have open Q&A.
Should I rebuttal? I'm sorry, the middle person.
That's right.
Brother Michael and I have a bit of a difference of opinion. My review of the Pennsylvania statistics is that 3 to 4% of the companies recycle. 90% I've never heard of. In terms of regulations, the poor owner who wants to develop his property for gas, New York has forced integration. A law which was passed by the legislature in the midnight hours a few years ago basically says a New York resident has no choice. Forced integration, if I don't want to open my mineral rights up to a gas company, but they want to put that across the street, I that's forced integration, forced pooling. I have no choice. With respect to the New York has had fracked wells or conventional wells, well, the fact of the matter is that the current estimates is that New York will have developed, if the moratorium is lifted, between 36 and 78,000 wells. Well pads, not wells, well pads. Multiply that by the number of wells, the number of frack stages. And the statistics that I have heard is that fracking's been around for a while, not high volume fracking in New York. And that the wells in New York that exist, to my understanding, were not high volume. They used about 80,000 gallons per well, not 5 or 6 or 8 million that you have now. And the statistic that I heard is that the first 1,000 high volume hydrofrac wells that are going to be, again, if the moratorium is lifted, drilled in New York, The volume of fracking fluid in the first 1,000 wells in New York will exceed the volume of fracking fluid used in every well in New York since they were drilled. Which also raises a very interesting question. A lot of people don't even know where these old wells are. They don't know where the cement casings are. Nobody knows the condition of the cement casings. Okay? And the DEP and even Chesapeake, which is a big producer in Pennsylvania, admits that they have casing problems. So if you admit that you have casing problems, and you know that a quarter of the casings are going to fail before or during production, and three quarters are going to fail thereafter, and you know it creates a problem, then why on earth would you want to drop 78,000 wells in New York? This is not a question of and this is what the gas company likes to do. They like to pit if you have concerns, you're anti-gas. If you don't have concerns, you're an anti-environment. No, there's a happy medium, okay? You want to have pre-testing? And this is some of the defenses that the gas companies use. Oh, that methane's been there for a while. Yeah, it's been there for a while, but it hasn't been in John Smith's well for 25 years until you put up your well. Maybe that's a coincidence. But then Mr. Jones, a half mile away, who lived in his house for 30 years, never had any methane in his well, now he's got methane bubbling up. He's got methane in his toilet. He can't drink his water. Gee, that was 3 months after Chesapeake or whatever company drilled the well. Okay, after a while, okay, remember, you kind of get the big picture. The gas company wants you to focus on, it's an old technology, not a big deal, it's been proven. But, okay, step back. Look at it logically. Then why are these people having problems? Yeah. Have some people in Duke been able to light their water on fire? I don't know. I guess so. Okay. But you see this condition going on in other places. And is it just a coincidence? I don't know. But like I say, when a gas company admits that some of the cement casings are compromised, it's a problem. And it's not just the drilling. take your car, if you got nothing to do, and go to go to Bradford County, some of these small towns. It's really unbelievable. Okay, it's just truck after truck, water truck, tanker truck. I mean, it's just tearing up the roads. And again, you want to look at the cost of methane versus, or natural gas versus oil. Okay, we can look at that. That's a static analysis. Okay, I like to look at things dynamically. What does it cost to take that gas out? You got to get trucks. It's going to tear the roads up. Okay, who's going to pay for that? You may disrupt people's lives. And it's not just, how do you get the gas from the well to where you want it used? Well, you got to build compressor stations. Anybody know what a compressor station is? I mean, you got this wellhead, how do you take the gas and now put it into your pipeline? You've got to build these very large compressor stations run by diesel engines, which have vibrations, emissions. And again, when you get the whole story, you realize this is not just a very simple, you know, drill a hole, take the gas out, and everybody's happy. You know, tires.
Nothing better than listening to an eloquent trial lawyer, because it sounds so convincing. If any of it were actually true, I'd be alive. Forced integration. 49 states have forced integration statutes on the books. New York's not in the waning hours of 2005. Actually, in 1969. It was revised in 2005, that's true. I was actually one of the prime draftsmen of revising that law, which has as its fundamental tenets to prevent waste. It sounds like a reasonable thing to do. To promote the greater ultimate recovery of oil and natural gas, that seems like a reasonable thing to do. And to protect correlative rights of those people who wish to exploit their minerals, and the correlative rights of those people who don't want to exploit their minerals. This also seems to me to be a pretty reasonable thing to do. So it's a matter of perspective. Are you going to tell the whole story, or are you going to tell that part of it that speaks to a jury? I think if you see the whole story, you'll realize that there's a good reason for protecting relative rights. It prevents the issue of line drilling. What you own, as I said, is the right to drill and explore for oil and gas, and to reduce it to possession of the law of action. But under that rule, so does your neighbor. So what your neighbor do to protect their property? They drill a well on their property that drains your gas. And you end up with a proliferation of wells. Generally speaking, bad for the environment, bad for the resource. So if you create a common pool and you put in one well that optimally drains the entire area, you've prevented waste. You've promoted greater ultimate recovery of the resource, and of course you've paid all those people within that area of drainage for the commodity produced beneath their property. It seems to me that that's a far greater solution than simply allowing the neighbor to drill the well and drain the property of the person next to them. 36,000 to 78,000 wells, ladies and gentlemen, I will submit to you is a lie. Nothing other than a lie. The best estimates that I've heard from the industry are somewhere on the order of 36 to 78 wells in a given year. Wells are drilled from a common pad, that's true. We now have the ability to drill one pad, generally 1 to 5 acres, and drill 8 well bores off of it, draining somewhere probably in excess of 640 acres, which is a square mile. Probably now up to about 2 square miles, reducing the total footprint of your natural gas wells on the environment. There is no conceivable way that the New York State DEC could permit anywhere on the order of 36 to 78,000 wells on any type of reasonable basis. And it is against the law to commence drilling without a permit. There is a check against that system. This is not a group of trucks idling at the border waiting to rush into New York. And last, I think we should take into consideration the fact that there are only about 1,600 drilling rigs in the country, in all of the United States, that are even capable of drilling one of these wells. So all those shale basins that you've seen up, all those states that are open to drilling, all that productivity around the country, shut it all off, move every one of those rigs to New York State. We now have 1,600 in the state, and drill about one well a month. Start doing the math. If you assume all of those ridiculous assumptions, you might start getting close to what's at least possible. A quarter of the production casing fails. Well, that may be Mr. Kemp's observation, but in 2005, the EPA studied hydraulic fracturing. They studied 1.1 million wells and found zero. I'll say that again. 1.1 million wells, zero confirmed incidences of groundwater contamination caused by hydrofracking. The New York State DEC also studies this. When they issued the draft, generic environmental draft, supplemental generic environmental impact statement, they confirmed zero cases of groundwater contamination caused by hydraulic fracking. So there's, again, the observations, and then there's the peer-reviewed science and agency oversight. There seem to be a marked disparity between the two. And finally, let's touch on compressors that, generally speaking, incidentally run off natural gas, not diesel. You obviously have natural gas available. You run it through your compressor. It's actually called gas used on lease, and usually speaking, it comes off the production before you compute your royalties. They've also instituted both noise and air mitigation techniques because natural gas compressors are frankly loud, comparatively speaking. But again, the idea of an unconventional resource is not only to tap the source, but also to commingle as many wells as you can together to reduce the infrastructure load, reduce the number of pipelines, and move as much gas as you can. So if your alternative is to drill more wells, or build a compressor, the compressors will obviously make sense. So, I think let's go into the debate portion. We might have some interesting things to see or hear then. Let's see.
Thank you very much. We're going to take Q&A. I'd just like to ask one question too, Mr. Camps. It seems like you've identified two major issues, the well casings and the possible contamination of water sources.
Yeah.
It seems like the well casings is something that we possibly could fix, and the contamination is something that we might not be able to fix. When you're doing a trial or finding a trial, is there in some option somewhere in the middle where you tell the court or the jury something that if the gas companies would do this, then that would be safe, but they're not doing it?
I got a couple questions there. When I try a case, it's usually just there's been damage caused by, and it can be either a bad casing, which sometimes can or cannot be fixed. So the vernacular sometimes uses a slip job, where they will force concrete back down the annulus and try to, in effect, re-slip or recast the cement. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. In Dimmock, the DEP has said, and also in Bradford County, what the DEP said, because I know firsthand, I have a paper in the files, is that the casings are bad. And whether it's installation or something that's been compromised later, I don't know. With respect to the question of damages, and again, it's a very interesting issue. If my client's property has been contaminated, let's say it's methane, and we prove, which we have to prove, you know, I'm not a Svengali, I don't get up here and just, you know, yell statistics off, but if we prove it, that the gas migration was caused by whatever bad casing, then it's a question of what's the diminution of value of the property. The interesting issue is that if a slip job does work, okay, could that methane contamination come back again? People can speculate to that, but the question is that it's what's the public's perception of that. Now, maybe it's not fair to the gas company, but it's also not fair to the homeowner. I mean, ask yourself this question. Would you pay the same price, given two houses a mile away from each other, the identical house, the identical price? One had a history of methane or fugitive gas migration into its water supply. Which house would you buy? If you were a bank writing a mortgage, would you want to write a mortgage knowing that perhaps your collateral is at risk? That's just the realities of it. I don't know if I've answered your question.
I'm asking a question.
Sure, go ahead.
I guess my question would be actually for Michael.
Sure.
There clearly have been some accidents, and the companies have admitted there's been operator error, there's been spills, there's been some cement casings damaged. To me, this seems to be, the industry should really be perfect. There's got to be more the industry can do, because to me, any drinking well that's damaged is one too many. And I just want to question your opinion. Isn't there more the industry can do? Because I understand that something happens maybe once every 5 years, once every 10 years. But the number of incidences is high. And there should be more that can be done. And what's your view of what can be done to really get rid of, you know,
first of all, My view is that that everything that can be done should be done to reduce any incidents. I don't agree with the anecdotal statement that there are a high number of instances. I think if you actually look at the statistics from the reporting agencies from the various producing states, it tells a very different story in the very safe industry. Pennsylvania is actually a pretty good example of a state that could use a lot of improvement. Pennsylvania, for instance, does not have comprehensive casing requirements on the books as part of its regulatory program. Compare that to New York, for instance. I'll give you what a good regulatory structure looks like. You begin by setting surface casing, a 24-inch diameter casing that literally goes through the unconsolidated material, soil, till, whatever it happens to be, until it hits competent bedrock. There's a cup put on the bottom. You cement that back into place so that you've got not only steel casing, but also cement in place. You then drill your intermediate section through your bedrock, through your potable aquifer zone. That's usually drilled with either 17 7/8 or 7 7/8 inch pipe to at least 100 feet below the deepest depth of known potable aquifer in that area. Potable water in that area. In New York, that's anywhere from 400 to 1,000 feet. Again, that casing is then cemented in place. While that process is ongoing, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has an inspector on site to physically observe the cement return to the surface. And if you don't have a cement return, the cement has to be set up, and the actual technique is called a bullhead squeeze, where you squeeze cement down the angle of space until you have a return. And you have it, the officer, not only do you have to show that physical return, but there's also a cement log that's required to be kept so that you can volumetrically compute the amount. We're adding a new process under the generic environmental impact statement to also have a cement log done to verify the competency of the cement. But we're not done there. After that, as you then drill your intermediate strip, which just gets you from below the aquifer zone to the point where you're going to kick off, you again cement that until you have a return back. And then use really your production strength, and you cement that in place. And in New York, this is all done by regulation. Those regulations, frankly, don't exist in Pennsylvania, and the industry is essentially using best technologies to do it. What actually happened in the incident in Dimmock is that they hit a water zone unbeknownst to them, and the water, quite literally, the subsurface was flowing, as I understand it, through the cementing process and cutting the cement. So it was basically watering down the cement so that it wasn't competent. So the issue in Dimmock was not hydrofracking 4,000 or 5,000 feet above the surface. It was actually a fairly near surface event where the well wasn't properly cemented in place. And that is something, incidentally, that would have been avoided under even New York regulations.
Quick tactical question. In New York State right now, what is, you've
Paul mentioned moratorium where it would be lifted or something. What is the current law? How long does that prevail? Is there some sort of sunset provision? And what motions are there, what legislation or regulation is there to change it? If you just set the stage for us, where are we right now in New York?
Well, presently there is, we use the word moratorium, that's as in appropriate. Presently there's an executive order in place mm-hmm. that prohibits high volume hydrofracking of shale formations. High volume being literally defined as any fracking involving 80,000 gallons or more of fracture fluid. That executive order is set to expire on June 1st. Notwithstanding the executive order, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, under a mandate by Governor Patterson, is undertaking to supplement the existing generic environmental impact statement for gas drilling and development. And the supplement is to cover the delta between hydrofracking using up to 80,000 gallons of fracture stimulation fluid per project and volumes up to and exceeding potentially 8 million gallons. New York does not have a drilling moratorium in place. You can still drill wells in New York. In 2010, I think about 550 wells. You can still drill horizontal wells in New York State. You simply cannot permit, drill, and fracture a well using more than 80,000 gallons of stimulation fluid, and you will not be able to do that until the supplemental generic environmental impact statement has been completed, vetted, and no doubt litigated.
I just add, it looks like it's possible so that the supplemental environmental impact statement went out was a draft, and DEC never finalized it. The thinking is under the Cuomo administration that there may be another draft that's released for public comment. So you're probably talking a year to year and a half, even.
Last I heard from DEC is that they're not issuing another draft. It's coming out as a final. They will take comments on the final, but you're looking after the draft comes out. That document is not the final document that enables you to proceed with a permit. They then have to issue another document signed off by the various departments approving the SGEMS. That is the final document. That will be subject to litigation. They may take additional comments, but I've heard that they're not going to do it.
Questions for Professor Joy, but I think may also be applicable to others. So I'm going to focus on air emissions.
Sure.
With like the flaring and venting of natural gas,
yes.
The glycol dehydrators, compressor stations, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, hazardous air pollutants that get emitted, you know, xylene, benzene, those types of stuff.
If you're using diesel, that would be crushed.
But even methane releases benzene and xylene when they flare it and they vent it. And my question is, under the Clean Air Act, there are exemptions for the oil and gas industry, specifically for the hazardous air pollutants section, that pretty much wholesale exempt these two industries when they do well jobs. But one of the exceptions to the exception is based on if the wells are in metropolitan statistical areas of over 1 million people.
Okay.
And Pittsburgh, Columbus, Ohio, Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington, those are three metropolitan statistical areas over 1 million people. My question then is, why haven't we seen more citizen suits based on that premise that the DEP, for example, in Pennsylvania or the Texas, whatever it is, Railroad Commission. Right. Why have they not been sued by citizens or the EPA, for that matter, based on the fact that wells are being drilled in these metropolitan statistical areas and thus they qualify as an area source and then can be regulated under the Clean Air Act?
I'd have to look to see if there are any wells that have been drilled within metropolitan Pittsburgh. That I'm not certain of. Certainly there are in Dallas-Fort Worth. I mean, the Barnett Shale definitely underlies the area. Why there haven't been citizen suits, frankly, is something of a mystery if there's anything that's in compliance, because there's a very aggressive plaintiff's bar.
Right. I mean, the metropolitan statistical area is not necessarily the bounds of the city.
I'm afraid I don't have the answer.
I think it should be a question for the plaintiff's bar then.
Well, I can tell you that under the Pennsylvania statute, section 115 of the Pennsylvania statute 35620.1115, I think it is, which is the citizen's suit, it's really probably, which permits, for those who don't know, it basically puts the anybody affected by contamination of a hazardous waste, put you in the shoes of a state's attorney general. You can commence an action on behalf of the citizens and, in fact, be entitled to attorney's fees. There is a statutory prerequisite that before you can initiate a tort claim, if you will, before you can initiate a citizen suit under 1115, you have to put the municipality and the DEP on notice, wait 60 days, see if they act, and then if they don't act, then you can proceed. Quite frankly, I think maybe the better practice, if you're going to sue in tort and get your specific damages, you don't need the citizen's suit. You can just proceed by way of tort. That's how I've chosen to do it, instead of waiting 60 days. But you pose a very good question, and I think that I think where you're going to find perhaps more citizen suits are the individuals who may not have a direct impact due to contamination, but maybe some indirect impact, maybe not a landowner, maybe a leaseholder, and then the question is, are they impacted by the pollution? That's an interesting question. I will also, just if I could, just on a previous question, the so-called moratorium in New York is correct. I think people have the mistaken belief that it's a moratorium on all high-volume fracking, or it's at least presumably, of course, applicable to the Marcellus sale. In an area called Big Flats, New York, which is about an hour west of Binghamton on the Pennsylvania-New York border in New York, there is a neighborhood about half a mile from a drilling site operated by Anschultz. It's a natural gas company. There's about 20 homes that now have methane migrating into their house and into their well. And that well goes into the Trenton Black River formation, not the Marcellus. And it was interesting because I was notified and went out there and met with those residents. And I was a bit surprised, quite frankly, that they had this methane migration, that they were actually drilling. I thought that the moratorium may have applied there. But again, this is another situation where, again, this is a neighborhood that's 25 years old. The houses are on, I'd say, a third of an acre plots. And 15 or 16 of the houses have, it's confirmed, there's no issue about it, very high levels of methane in their drinking water. Is it coincidence? 22, 25 years, never had a problem. Now all of a sudden, a gas rig goes up, and 3 months later, methane's migrating into people's houses. Tell it to them. It's a coincidence.
And so Anschutz is doing exactly that and vigorously defending that.
And all these gas companies are vigorously defending. And one of the things that the gas companies are very worried about, and that is, they are fighting tooth and nail in Pennsylvania, and we'll fight tooth and nail in New York. They do not want a court ruling that natural gas exploration and production is an ultra-hazardous activity, because if that were to be the case, then strict liability will apply. The cases that I filed in Pennsylvania, defendant immediately moved under 12b-6 to strike the pleadings and to strike the cause of action sounding a strict liability. Many states, like Texas, very favorable for the oil and gas industry. There's court rulings that say it's not, as a matter of law, an ultra-hazardous activity. The case is Berish, B-E-R-I-S-H, versus Southwestern Energy Company. The two opinions out of the Middle District of Pennsylvania, the courts have said, look, we don't know whether this is an ultra-hazardous activity. We need more discovery. What the gas companies did is basically say, judge, strike that cause of action. This is not an ultra-hazardous activity, without there being any discovery, without there being anything.
And the judge, of course, agreed with us and said, "Judge, we don't even know. We don't know what's in their drilling fluid. We don't know what they're doing. You know, we have radon in water. We have strontium in water. We need some more discovery to determine it." But this is the gas company's very, very, very concerned that they'll get a bad ruling from Pennsylvania court or any state court finding that their activities are ultra hazardous, because it obviously decreases the proof standard for plants.
Or it could be that they're not ultra hazardous.
I know. So
right. Well, you know, it may not be ultra hazardous, and which gets back to your question. If it's not ultra hazardous and there's nothing, the fracking fluids and whatever the gas industry does is innocuous, then why do you want exemptions from the Clean Water or clean air? Why fight tooth and nail for exemptions if you have nothing to hide?
I know some environmental professors on the right believe that when damages do occur, it's sufficient to use strictly private property tort, you know, and contract paradigm to recover damages, and no regulations are necessary. I was wondering if you can address that.
I'm not quite sure I understand it. Are you suggesting there should be a regulatory structure for damages?
No, the opposite. That using just a private property tort structure is sufficient to deterrence, I say, for you know, negligent behavior on the part of the companies, and this vast regulatory structure is unnecessary.
I'll give you my opinion on that, if you will. This is just based upon what I've seen, the reactions from the gas company. The reaction typically is, your water's fine. Drink the water. Well, no, the water's fine. They get to the point where they realize the water's not fine. What they'll do is they'll put a water buffalo, which is a storage tank. They'll give the owner a storage tank of water. They'll keep that for about 6 months, hoping that the gas company, hoping that the water, the well water, clears itself up, okay? If it doesn't clear itself up, the next card that they play is, we'll put an on-site whole house water filtration system, which will take care of the manganese, the barium, the iron, whatever they're finding in the water. They hope the homeowner goes away with that. Now, it's worked, because a lot of these, you know, with the drilling, as I said before, most of it started in very, very rural areas. You may have somebody that has a property that's worth, you know, $20,000 or $30,000, you know, dirt poor person. They're happy to get their filtration system, and then that's it. There's no litigation. There's nothing. The proliferation of litigation is occurring, quite frankly, because you may get clusters of 10 or 15 homeowners affected in, say, a mile radius, or a large dairy farm where the animals are not drinking, or the animals are getting sick. So now, quite frankly, it's perhaps more cost-effective, if you will, okay, to retain legal counsel. Somebody in the foothills of West Virginia is not going to be able to afford counsel. He's going to take his filtration system, and that's the end of it.
Doesn't it work on contingency fees, though?
Say again?
Don't these suits work on contingency
fees? Yes, you can work on contingency fees, but if you have to, which you have to do, use an expert and survive a Daubert motion at trial, and it may cost you, if you're lucky, $20,000 or $30,000 between a hydrogeologist, a appraiser for the property, at a bare minimum, and the property of your client is worth $40,000 or $50,000 literally, are you doing a service to that client? It's the typical win the battle and lose the war. And look, like I said, I'm a free market capitalist. I'm not one of these things where, you know, corporations are all evil, okay? But, and I think Mike makes some excellent points, and I think we probably agree more than we disagree. I guess I really don't, okay? Clients call me all the time, or people call me all the time and say, look, they're starting to drill. How do I protect myself? Well, I don't go sit there and say, oh, that's an evil company, you're going to get screwed. No. I say, well, to protect yourself, get a water test, get a pretest. Now, in Pennsylvania, if you're within 1,000 feet, the gas company usually will order a test for itself to protect itself. But
a comprehensive water test, if you want to protect yourself, basically to say, hey, what was my water like before the drilling? And now if I think it gets contaminated, okay, how do I, as a homeowner, respond to the defense of the gas company? Well, your water was bad all the time. How do you, as a homeowner, disprove it? Well, you've got to get a water test. That's about $1,000. You want to test for heavy metals. You want to test for VOCs. It's not a simple test where you're just checking for bacteria, okay? Now, that's expensive. Who should pay for that? Now, it may not be, you know, $1,000 to a lot of people. They're just not going to do it. So, you know, look, nobody's in the, look, I'm not, and I think that most plaintiffs' lawyers, okay, are not in the business of, you know, drumming up business, trying to, you know, make cases where they don't exist. I think it's ethically improper. I think it is, but I agree with Mike. I said, and I agree with that. Not every gas company is evil. I don't think any gas company is evil. But there's certain protocol that I think should be followed, and really it should be enacted.
The other advantage to the industry is by having regulation is it creates an equal playing field. And so the ones that are going to be think about money and cut corners won't be able to do so. So there's a lot of advantages to the companies themselves if everyone has the same regulations and they know the true cost of producing gas, which ultimately we pay for anyway.
Let's look at Pennsylvania, for example. There's actually a statute in Pennsylvania that provides that if you do pre-well testing within 1,000 feet of the well, you establish a baseline. If you fail to do that, there's a presumption against you, there's a presumption against the industry, that any change in the potable quality of the water is held against the company. There's an incentive to go out and do pre-drill testing. Now, is there an incentive to do it as a standard practice? It's not 1,000 feet. It's closer to 2,500 feet. And in fact, most companies operating in Pennsylvania, or at least the ones that I work with, are going a step beyond, because a lot of places are, in fact, rural, and there aren't water sources. There are not wells within 1,000 feet. They're drilling their own wells.
Right.
Sure.